paper.
Welcome to episode 23 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Mina Takahashi, editor of Hand Papermaking magazine. In this episode, Mina reveals how a college internship in Philadelphia planted the seed for her career in hand papermaking. She talks about a key moment when a Japanese papermaker showed her his hands and she understood what it means to dedicate yourself to a process, material, and way of life. And she discusses her visit to a Thai village where they made hospital gowns out of handmade paper. We also talk about her work as an advocate and promoter for hand papermaking as an artistic medium when she worked at Dudonné Paper Mill and in her current position as editor of Hand Papermaking magazine.
Hi, it's Helen with Paper Talk, and I'm in Brooklyn, New York with Mina Takahashi. Hi, Mina.
Hi, Helen.
It's great to be here with you. And how did you first get interested in paper?
I went to college at Oberlin, and there's a winter term that's part of the academic year. And you have an advisor, and you go see your advisor, and you talk about what you're going to do for your winter term. And I had no ideas. I lived near Philadelphia, and my advisor, who was an English professor, I don't know why, I wasn't really interested in studying English, but or literature, but he had a brother who taught at the University of Pennsylvania, and he thought that maybe I'd be interested in doing something at the museum there, at the University of Pennsylvania Archaeological and Anthropological Museum there.
Okay, so the winter term was like, could be anywhere.
Yeah, you could take classes at on campus.
Okay.
You can go and do your own studies elsewhere. Internships were a very common thing during the winter term. And so he hooked me up with an internship at this university museum. And I think for that January, I probably lived in town at a friend's apartment and just traveled to the museum, and I showed up and they happened to be working on their Pacific collection. And they have a beautiful collection of tapa.
Tell us a little bit about what tapa is.
Okay, tapa is bark cloth,
right.
And from the Polynesian Islands, and I was working specifically, I think, and mainly with the Samoan and the Fijian tapa collection first at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, and then also at the Smithsonian, and it's tapa bark cloth. What is the inner bast of the paper mulberry, and in these tropical regions are kind of more tree-like, so they're nice, big, thick pieces of inner bast that they would beat to widen and soften and rinse in the water, and then be able to piece them together to make bed coverings and, you know, also the more then became as you move into the late 19th century, early 20th century, became kind of more like tapestries, and then moved into more of a tourist trade item. But you know, they were originally ceremonial clothing and items that were used in daily life too. And they were getting ready, I think preparing it for an exhibition, and they had them stored away, folded in drawers.
Wow.
And they pulled these items out, and they realized folding was probably not such a great idea, long-term storage. So I think they got a grant maybe to pull all these items out, do a little steam relaxation treatment on them, and then roll them onto acid-free core rolls and wrap them with acid-free paper and acid-free ties and all this. And that was my job. I worked on their tapa collection and did that all winter. And then I ended up going back in the summertime and kind of continuing that project and some other things. And then with that experience, I was able to get, I think, a following winter term project at the Smithsonian. And they were getting ready for like some big, I think, Cook Expedition exhibition. And they needed their tapa relaxed and restored.
An
and I became the expert tapa relaxer. Uh-huh. And it was wonderful because I think it's your probably pretty coveted internship, so I was lucky to have that. And so I was working on their collection there, and as part of the time there, I went out to their conservation lab, which wasn't in the main, on the mall. It was in Virginia, uh-huh. and met the conservators there. Uh-huh. And this must have been in my sophomore year, because I knew I was going to Japan in my junior year abroad, to Kyoto.
Oh, okay.
And the conservator there said, oh, well, you must be excited about going to check out Japanese paper.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. She goes, well, you're working on tapa. Of course you'd be interested in Japanese paper. And I said, well, I don't know. Isn't Japanese paper made out of rice?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, her face fell, you know, her jaw dropped. And she, you know, schooled me on, obviously we all know, you know, that Japanese paper is made from paper mulberry, as is tapa. So I kind of was a little bit shamed into learning more about Japanese paper. So, you know, with this very same material, with a very different kind of processing, the Japanese, and also very different fiber, because this paper mulberry grows very differently in a more temperate region, climate like Japan. And so, you know, I then really became interested in this material and how it can be transformed into paper. And, you know, you get Tim Barrett's book out, you start looking at Dart Hunter books. And then when I was in Japan, I, you know, was continuing to find interest in that topic. And, you know, the one thing you would do as a year abroad student in Japan is you find some destination you're going to go to for a hitchhiking trip. Usually it's like spring term, spring break. And so two friends in the program, I was in a program in Kyoto called AKP, the Shady Kyoto program. We decided that we should go and meet some paper makers. And so we had our final, you know, like the mecca, the main destination was to meet Iwano-san in Imadate in mm-hmm. Fukui Prefecture, who was a national treasure for his woodblock paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of made our way to that region, and the event of meeting him, like, really, that really kind of like changed my life. Just seeing someone who was the kind of dedication he had to his craft, and, you know, kind of the one key moment was, you know, when you meet someone in Japan, typically there's bowing involved, there's no real handshaking,
right.
You know, this is the traditional greeting, is to bow. And so, you know, you get used to, you just put your hands behind, or, you know, to your sides, or a clasp behind your back, and you bow respectfully. And I was getting, you know, moving into a deep bow when we met Iwano-san, and he thrusted his hands into, you know, kind of as we were leaning forward. And I thought, he wants to do a Western greeting.
Uh-huh.
He wants to shake our hands. And then I realized he wasn't really putting his hands in a shaking sort of position. He was actually showing the palms of his hands to us. And he was saying, he was showing us with his hands what his craft was.
Mm-hmm.
His hands were, you know, red and cracked. He'd just done all this rinsing of fiber in very, very cold water.
Uh-huh.
And he was, this is what he was doing. He was greeting us by telling us, this is how you know who I am, because I'm showing you my tools, my main tools.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of a revelation about just what it means to dedicate your life to a process, to a material, to, you know, to that life. Right. And yeah, it really that stayed with me. We had this wonderful trip, met several paper makers, but he was really, I think, the, you know, kind of, that was a real spark. And I just did more, you know, had more interest after that trip to really delve into, you know, going to paper stores and seeing, you know, who was making paper and trying to find all the, those wonderful, like, Mainichi, the tomes with all the paper samples in them, papers made in all these different regions in Japan. And when I returned to Oberlin for my final year, kind of got more and more interested. I found all the Dark Hunter books in the, you know, in the Mud Library collection, uh-huh. special collections, and found out about places like Judene Paper Mill, and thought like this might really be a life path. I started incorporating it. I took a couple of studio classes and was like, you know, working with paper a little bit there.
What was your major?
My major was in East Asian Studies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then towards the tail end of my senior year at Oberlin, you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I graduate. Okay. There's this great, there were a lot of the liberal arts colleges participate in this, the Watson Fellowship mm-hmm. program, and Oberlin is a constituent college in that. And so I applied to study papermaking in Japan, Korea, and Thailand. That was my proposal. And I received a Watson Fellowship, which gave me a full year to really delve into those studies in Japan. And I actually, you know, because I have family there, I was also able to kind of really stretch that fellowship. Uh-huh. And I stayed for 2 years and traveled and studied intensively with a number of paper makers in different regions, making different kinds of paper. And that was really actually was kind of fascinating, because I was so attuned, I was so interested in the regional differences with these different paper makers and the different kind of papers that they were making. And every time I would go visit or stay or study with a paper maker, they'd always say, "Oh, I make it just like everyone else." And I guess I haven't really thought about it recently, you know, why that reaction, or why, you know, if they are being modest, or I was asking too many pesky questions that were too specific, and they weren't quite prepared to, you know, either for proprietary reasons or just because they just have their way that they've been doing it for ever since they've made paper, and that they're father had made paper or their mother had made paper, you know, but it was interesting. That was always the return comment. Mm-hmm. And then I would, you know, I started binding my samples of paper that I would either make or have been gifted or purchased from paper makers all over Japan. And I'd say, well, how can you call this the same paper as this paper, and it's a completely different color, it's a totally different surface, different rattle,
right?
You know, and then you can talk about it with them if you have the papers in front of you, you can talk mm-hmm. about them more specifically, mm-hmm. and then they would say, like, oh yeah, this paper was made in the summertime versus in the wintertime. Mm. I said, even your own paper is different from season to season. And then we would, you know, kind of move into more detailed conversations, and that was always fun. But, so that was an amazing, amazing experience to be able to have lived and studied and just worked that intensely in these studios.
Yeah. And how did you plan your itinerary? Did it just kind of come go from one to the next, or did you have it all mapped out, or? And some other Westerners had been there prior to you.
Sure, right? Yeah.
So you must have.
Yeah, I haven't got a bus in a long time, but I do remember that my proposal was very specific, and I had letters too, from some of these places. I think I went to Kuretani, which is near Kyoto, where I was studying when I was that year abroad, and I met the head of the cooperative there, and I think he wrote me a letter saying that he would invite me. And I think there was a little bit of a miscommunication. I think I might have said 6 months, and I think he had thought it was more like 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, like, oh, I'm going to spend 6 months at Kuretani, kind of, learn the skill base, and then travel, and meet and sort of observe at different studios throughout the country. And then when I actually I got the grant, and I arrived in Kuretani. And I said, okay, so where do I settle in for 6 months?
Right.
And he said, oh, we don't do that here in Ukraine. And I panicked. I thought, okay, well, now what am I going to do? And it was right around the time that they have a couple of associations. One is sort of the Young Papermakers Association, and the other one's sort of the National Papermakers Association. Those are all the wise old papermakers who meet and basically just drink and talk. But they were meeting, I think, shortly after I arrived there, and he took me to this meeting and introduced me to all his pals.
Oh, wow.
And at that meeting, I could see one saying, I'll take her for those 2 months, and then someone saying, oh, yeah, I'll take her for the other three. And and so an itinerary kind of formed,
right.
Because they were all, wanting to help their friend out who couldn't fulfill, what we had thought was the plan, but... It was wonderful. It was a wonderful way to be introduced to them, and then also, to think that I was originally to think that it would be best to kind of stay in one place and sort of really learn the basic skill set, and then to just observe in these different places, I would have had a very different experience.
Sure.
What my experience ended up being is kind of going very deep into each different papermaker's process, mm-hmm. and just the way they conduct their life, because, you'd wake up to hand beading or to the beater, the naginata beater getting turned on, or, or the splashing of the fiber when they're doing the chitty-totty, the cleaning the fiber in the stream, and, all this. I was also very lucky that I was able to stay in the homes of a lot of these places. Mm-hmm. And so I was really kind of immersed in their daily life. It was extraordinary.
This episode of Paper Talk is sponsored by the Redcliffe Paper Retreat, an annual retreat held at Helen Hebert's studio in the heart of the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Enjoy 3 to 6 peaceful creative days in the tiny hamlet of Redcliffe, the weekend after Labor Day, surrounded by mountains, the river, and aspen trees as they begin to change their glorious fall colors. Experiment with several techniques as you create a variety of paper objects that will intrigue your eyes and illuminate your spirit. All levels of art experience are welcome. The 2018 retreat theme is illuminated paper. Come explore a variety of papers that are inherently transparent, discover ways to make paper translucent, and create structures that lend themselves to being illuminated, such as screens, lamps, lanterns, window treatments, and books. Explore these ideas as you create unique paper objects with like-minded people. Find out more at helenhebertstudio.com/Redcliffe Paper Retreat. That's HelenHiebert studio.com/Redcliffe Paper Retreat.
And so you spent, how long did you spend in Japan and then you went to Korea?
Yeah, I did that kind of maybe in between or, you know, it wasn't sort of a progression.
Okay.
You know, I kind of went back. I always went back to Japan. I have family there, I had friends there, yeah. And kind of had a home base in Kyoto, a city which I adore.
Yeah.
Korea was really interesting because my mother is Japanese, my mother was Japanese Korean and my father was Korean, and I had only traveled to my father's hometown twice in my life, and the mm-hmm. first time I was young,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 12, something like this, and the second time was when I went for this, to find paper,
mm-hmm.
and I remember saying to my uncle, who was still in the province of Andong, there are papers made all over. There's got to be paper made somewhere near here.
Yeah.
And he said, no, that's a long time ago, Mina. No one's doing that here.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of asked maybe someone had come to the house and I had asked that person. And, you know, then people are starting to ask around.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, I mean, really within 20 minutes, there was someone who was making paper and had just recently retired the old Korean molds. And they were moving into the Japanese setup because uh-huh. they are starting to get orders to make Japanese-style paper in Korea for export, basically out of Japan. To basically be sold as Japanese papers.
Mm.
So, you know, that's a more lucrative market, even though they're making it less expensively than the Japanese, but it's still more lucrative than making Korean-style paper, which had, by that point, you know, slightly limited use and a smaller market. So I could see they had just pretty much hung up these molds. And they pulled them down for me and demonstrated, and I was able to spend a couple of days working with this older equipment. And, I kind of caught it just before they were really switching over. I would be very surprised. I have this in my notes from so long ago, and I haven't really revisited it, but I'd be very surprised if they... if they even still have any of that equipment around.
Wow.
Or, I mean, who knows? Maybe they're back in the swing of it, you know. Who knows? But, so that was fascinating. Oh. And then Thailand was also really fascinating to... I went to the traditional places where, as a tourist, you can go and see, in Chiang Mai, you can see this craft, mainly being practiced for the tourist trade. And, you know, you ask around, and actually, the way I found this place was because it was a town, I can't remember the name of it, but it was in between Chiang Mai and Bangkok, and they supplied kozo, they grew kozo for the Japanese paper makers.
Uh-huh.
And I asked my Japanese contact if they knew if paper was also being made there in the place where they were cultivating the kozo, and they said yes. So they gave me an introduction letter, made my way down there, and found out that there was this village. Everything was being made sort of outdoors underneath like an open but roofed
mm-hmm.
kind of studio area, and they were making hospital gowns.
Wow.
Which was fascinating to me. But if you really think about it, the idea of procuring for rural hospitals, if you think of the cost of trying to buy in, commercial machine-made anything, probably more expensive than making it yourself right there in the village. You just, you know, there's no transport necessary. It's right there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were making hospital gowns and sort of I guess it was more gowns and kind of like covers.
Mm-hmm.
But they said it was all for the hospital. So that was fascinating. So I spent some time there and working with with the paper mulberry, which is probably much closer to the paper mulberry that that top is made from, in terms of the growing conditions. That was such a remarkable opportunity. But all the while, I was thinking about working with it in an art, and in artistic expression, or working with it creatively, and thinking, well, maybe there's a chance that I could pop my head into Jidenay in New York and maybe think about going to art school. And so when it was finally time, the money ran out, it was finally time to come back home, I went to New York and kind of got my nerve up and, rang that doorbell down at that crazy elevator down at 3 Crosby Street. Yeah. And went and visited Paul.
Uh-huh.
And
Paul Wong.
Wong. I didn't know he was there, but it was Sharon
so
Durr.
Sharon Durr just rang
the
bell.
Oh yeah, I didn't call or anything. I was like, what if they said no on the phone?
Right.
If I actually walk in the door, maybe I'll have more of a chance. But I remember, ringing that bell and then, hearing Sharon going, who's that? No one just shows up.
Right.
And then getting into that elevator that takes, I don't know, a good 5 minutes to go 5 floors up. And thinking that I'm going to open the door and someone's going to welcome me in. But, you kind of walk in, you go through that dark hallway and then you see that wood floor, which wasn't really a platform, but just a wood floor in the center of the space there.
The wet floor?
Not the wet floor. Before you get to the wet floor, there was that, it was a wood floored area where the dry studio was and where the kitchen was, and I saw the wood floor. I could hear all the splashing, kind of behind that area. And so I could hear water. And then I saw all these shoes lined up at the bench. And I thought, I just got back from Japan. I thought, oh, maybe I'm supposed to take off my shoes. So I said, oh, should I take off my shoes? I say. And then this face comes popping around the corner, around the wet floor, with looking at me like, who is this person? What is she asking us? And she goes, no, of course not. Just come on back here. We're in the middle of pulling this order. And so I climbed around. I was mortified. I can't believe that was the first impression they had of me. It was this strange question. And spoke with Sharon and Paul. I brought my Japanese paper sample book with all the papers that I made. And they actually, they granted me a good 15 minutes, and you know how busy it gets there. Yeah. They granted me 15 minutes to look at my papers. And then I was an intern, I think, kind of immediately. I think they needed someone for some project. So I started interning with Paul and Sharon. And then it moved on to helping Jill Bullitt when Jidenay first got his not-for-profit status. So I had returned, this was 1989.
Okay.
And Jidenay just got his not-for-profit status. Jill Bullitt was the new executive director and she needed some help. So I ended up, helping her out a little bit, was on some kind of part-time basis or something. And then Jill left after, it was probably about a year, maybe a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And we all kind of now who's gonna do her job? And by that point, I'd been kind of involved on the wet floor and then also helping Jill with some grant writing and
administrative
things. And so Sue and the board and Paul said, let's give Mina a chance. And yeah, I mean, really, it was kind of, it was amazing timing and another like amazing opportunity. And that's, you know, when I became program director and worked with Paul and then was there for
how long?
15 years. I think it was 14 and a half, 15 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and you took that. And so I came there in maybe 91, 92.
That sounds right.
And it was very similar. I called, and you answered the phone and said, I was like applying for a grant to go to Japan, which I never ended up doing. But I needed a nonprofit sponsor, and I'd heard of Dudonné somehow. I'd never been there. So I just called, and my recollection could be wrong, but you were just like, oh, yeah, we'll sponsor you. Let's meet for coffee. And it's so warm and welcoming. And so then, yeah, we had coffee, and I think...
And you're telling me about your screens. I remember you were really interested
making
in...
Sure
you were always interested in light and paper and... Yes. And you know, and this kind of, you know, the grid. You're always interested in the grid.
So, yeah, I think I was there for 6 years. So we overlapped. It was a fantastic time. So, Dudonné is a whole another
story. It's a whole another
podcast. And I'm interviewing Sue Gosen, so we'll leave it to that.
Perfect.
But so then you left there in
2004.
Yeah. So
kicking and screaming, you know, Marco had it in New York, and my husband Marco Blair.
Yeah.
And so we moved out of the city, and I mean, it took him 3 years to convince me to leave the city. I mean, I loved everything we were doing at Dudonné. It was an exciting time, you know. We were getting a lot of artists coming in, and starting to publish. It was fun, you know. I was working with artists in the studio, and so yeah, it was a little bit of a heartbreak to leave New York. But then we got into this whole other life, which was again just so unbelievable that I had this opportunity to spend 10 years, you know, farming
a farm.
Yeah. I mean, it took us several years to figure out that that's really what it was, but we knew it meant moving into the country. And if you want to move into the country and you want to move on land, onto a piece of land, you want to work the land. You know, if you want to live on a farm, you better work it as a farm. And so that's a whole, you know, another chapter which we just recently kind of closed. But
you've also been the editor of Hand Paper,
which was another amazing timing thing. You know, right when I was leaving Dudonné, Michael Durgan, the founder of Hand Paper Making, 18 years, he's like, that's it. I've done enough hand paper making magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting ready to retire. And it was just kind of perfect timing with my departure from Dudonné. I really wanted to make sure I kept those connections up, and also just was, you know, just had my finger on the pulse of what was happening in our community of paper. And
right.
So it was perfect. And, you know, I had done a little bit of publishing at Dudonné with some of our publications there, but Michael showed me, you know, just the ropes and just how to put together an issue and how to talk to authors and all of this. And I mean, I've been doing this now for crazy number of years. Okay, 2004, 2017. I've been doing that for 14 years. What?
Wow.
Actually, I think I started in 2005. Yeah, yeah. That was my first issue. And I mean, I love doing the magazine.
Mm-hmm. It's a great magazine.
Doing it. I love how the you know, we publish it twice a year. Mm-hmm. And it's a small run. It's 1,200 copies, and they have handmade paper tip-ins. And mm-hmm. Since I became editor, I've been pretty much organizing or curating each issue around a theme. Mm-hmm. And I just love how these themes kind of, they just sort of magically coalesce, you know, just things that I read or people introduce to me or what I pick up at, you know, at a conference, or certain ideas just percolate and get and are shared and come mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So that's just, it's always a joy when that finally makes itself known, and then I can go out and sort of fill in and commission pieces around a particular topic.
What's the next thing?
The next one is going to focus on water, mm-hmm. and looking at water as, you know, first of all, it's our most precious resource, mm-hmm. not just in life, but in paper making. And so looking at it as this essential force in our process. Also this notion of flow that we think of with water and how that impacts, I think, some of the work, the artwork that's made in our medium. And then I'm also looking at ways in which artists and also scientists who are examining and researching what's happening to our water resources environmentally. Mm-hmm. So that's been really fun. So it's pulling together science, chemistry, mm-hmm. Artists who are working in the field, so that's been exciting. And, you know, I always have to think a couple ahead.
Right.
So one that's a big issue, and it's been on my mind for many, many years, and I'm finally like gonna try to pull this one off. But, I'd love to put together a Merriam-Webster's of papermaking, of hand mm-hmm. papermaking, a dictionary. Mm-hmm. And also think about how it's a little working title that I use to amuse myself and also to kind of just, you know, try to think on the topic. But this one's, it's what we talk about when we talk about paper, you know, the Raymond Carver. So in my Word files, I have like, I'm all listed by issue number, and that one just keeps moving further down. You know, when we talk about paper, let's start talking about when we talk about paper, but maybe in a few years. That's something that's finally starting to, for instance, I'm working on curating the show right now with Sue Gosen for the International Print Center New York, mm-hmm. and I'm starting to put together the checklists, and I'm looking at the way we all describe paper works. And I mean, this is true in any medium,
yeah.
that everyone has a different way that they're going to describe the material, the process, you know, how they're going to, what is that wall label going to look like?
Right.
And how do you bring consistency to it in a show that's going to speak to not just paper makers, but to right. anyone who's going to look at this work and say, oh, I get what this is mm-hmm. when I read this thing. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is mm-hmm. kind of a fascinating mm-hmm. Topic, and I would love to kind of just sort of query all in museums, the American Museum of Papermaking, and collectors and right. artists, and sort of how do we, when we're describing a work for that purpose, what do we say?
Yeah.
And do we want to be consistent? Is it really about who the audience is and you adjust it for that? I think, you know, I think that's probably the most rational or most realistic way to, you know, that's what language as a shared language, you do adjust it depending on who you're talking to. But I do think that there's something there to discuss, and it would be interesting to kind of process.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I actually just interviewed Beck Whitehead recently, and she calls her, well, many people say pulp painting, but she calls her work paper paintings.
Yeah,
all kinds of
right
little ways of saying things.
Yeah. And I think there's, I just would like to hear what that means for someone, you know. I mean, because it's unusual, I'm sure she has thought, it's, she's has a, she's been thoughtful about it.
Right,
and,
sure.
And, yeah, I'd be interested in hearing, you know, her take on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Language. Yeah.
Okay, so let's wind up, wrap up with your next chapter. So you've just closed down the farm, I recently learned, and...
Yeah.
You're still upstate New York.
Yep, still upstate New York, but we're moving to a place where we are hoping we can kind of have a balance of some of the, you know, I'm not going to farm, for instance, I'm going to use the word garden. And so that it's not an absolute full-time ag life, but, you know, really stay connected to the land. I mean, you know, I still want to make maple syrup. I still want to have bees. So for honey and for pollinators, and you know, we still want to tap trees and you know, all of that. But also to be in a place. So right now I'm in Delaware County, which there's so many artists up there, and you know, old friends, new friends, poets, musicians, all kinds of visual artists. And to kind of really nurture that side of our interests, and finally build my paper studio. I have Bobby Littman's beautiful equipment, and you know I've pulled it out on occasions for some projects, but. I'm looking for the right place to set it up and really start doing, first of all, reacquaint myself with the process because it's been a few years. But I have so many artists upstate now. I look at their work and I just know what I want to do with them and really kind of move back into some of that collaborative work in the studio. So that's the next chapter.
Cool. Can't wait. All right. Well, thank you, Mina.
Thank you, Helen.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay updated is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio in Colorado. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, you'll notice I've done a bit more editing than usual. This is thanks to the help of Gary A. Hansen. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about Gary and his services. Subscribe to this series via iTunes. You can also leave a review. I'd appreciate that. And listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason.